A tense Middle East as world leaders call on Iran and Israel to avoid an escalation that could light the region on fire.
It could very well, and even in a matter of hours or days. That's how dangerous the situation is, because we're in uncharted territory.
A glimmer of hope for urgently needed aid as an overpowered Ukraine works to hold the line against Russian bombardments.
The Ukrainians are not running out of courage and tenacity. They're running out of ammunition. And we're running out of time to help them.
And the coordinated international effort to support the Ukrainian government investigate and prosecute war crimes committed during the Russian invasion of their country. But will justice be served if Ukraine falls? Today is Saturday, April 20th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel struck back at Iran Friday, days after Iran launched a retaliatory aerial strike on the Jewish state last Saturday. Tehran had vowed a massive response to even a small attack on its territory. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir caught up with Iran's foreign minister as he was heading into a meeting on Friday.
Foreign minister, any comment on last night's strike? Will Iran retaliate?
What a strike.
Iran's muted response appeared to signal a successful effort by diplomats who've been working to avert a region-wide war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Friday the United States was not involved in Israel's pre-dawn aerial strike inside Iran and declined to confirm reports that Washington was notified of Israel's plans shortly before the attack.
I'm not going to speak to what's been reported other than to say that the United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. The United States, along with our partners, will continue to work for de-escalation.
So what does come next? We're joined now by Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute.
There had been a lot of pressure on Israel not to retaliate against Iran to last weekend's attacks. Israel vowed it would, and it apparently now has. But Iran's president had warned that even a tiniest invasion on its territory would bring a massive response. So what happens now? Was it strategic? Do you see Iran responding? Because we haven't heard much.
I think this was a fairly targeted attack. It did not touch the nuclear facilities, which were the most sensitive. But it's anyone's guess, honestly, how Iran might respond, because Iran, I think, has a strong self-interest in not seeing this war that's emerged become even larger, because they're weaker when it comes to a conventional military perspective. So what we have going on right here is that for essentially decades, Iran and Israel have been engaged in a shadow conflict, mostly done through terrorist acts and proxies and Israel conducting assassinations of nuclear scientists. Now what we're seeing is a low-grade open war between these two countries. That's what's happened in the last week. And whether that sort of continues in the open or whether it moves back into the shadows is an open question. But what's not in question is for sure the conflict between Iran and Israel will continue.
So could this sort of unprecedented shift in how the two are responding to one another, could this potentially tip the scales into a wider escalation in the region? And what would the risks of that be?
It could very well, and even in a matter of hours or days. That's how dangerous the situation is, because we're in uncharted territory. The key variable, the key actor I'd watch very carefully, and I'm watching carefully in my own work, is Lebanon's Hezbollah, the group that Iran has backed for decades and has given not only monetary support, but actually has helped Hezbollah arm up. And Hezbollah, since October 7th, has stepped up some of its attacks across the border with Israel, but they've kept it within certain boundaries because they did not want to see Lebanon get embroiled in the sort of war that it had experienced with Israel in 2006, which was devastating. But I'd watch very carefully what Hezbollah does at this moment, because they're parked right there along Israel's northern border in Lebanon. They've more or less held their fire since October 7th began, and in part because the U.S. sent two aircraft carrier groups to the region, and President Biden famously said, don't. And thus far, They've conducted, again, small-scale attacks, but nothing that has led to an escalation. If they jump in, then I think we're in a different phase.
And what would that look like? Would that mean the potential to draw in the U.S. and other Western powers?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like this spiral, that would suck, a vortex that would suck not just the U.S., but some of the countries in the region in. And you sort of had a test case of this past weekend when Iran attacked Israel with 350 missiles and drones. A lot of the countries like Jordan have been reluctant to openly take actions in the open that puts them at odds with Iran, but they shot down missiles that were headed to Israel. So that scenario that I painted for you, and it's a nightmare scenario, I hope it can be avoided. But if Hezbollah jumps in, then I think it then brings in the United States more directly. The U.S. has said it would use its capabilities to defend Israel in that instance, you know, and despite the recent criticisms the Biden team and others have had about Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza, I think all bets are off then, because if Israel is attacked from this northern front in a big way by Hezbollah, backed by Iran, then I think you actually have that conventional regional military war that the Biden team has been trying to avoid.
So the situation is clearly drawing attention away from this very, very serious humanitarian situation, the continuation of the war in Gaza. What does this mean for any sort of ceasefire talks, hostage release, which, you know, we've been kind of hearing things from Hamas that they don't even potentially have enough hostages to negotiate with at this point? What does all of this mean for the situation in Gaza, given that that's still happening as well?
Well, it means even before this escalation between Israel and Iran, there were fading hopes that a temporary ceasefire and a hostage release would be achieved. And in my work and my discussions with individuals involved with these negotiations, there's been a common understanding that Hamas, in a sense, may have been playing a shell game here with the hostages and trying to buy for time. And Hamas, every time it sees differences between the United States and Israel emerge, or every time it sees election results, as we saw in the Michigan primary elections, where they see some dissent against the Biden approach, their price in the negotiations for a hostage release and temporary ceasefire went up. So I think the odds weren't looking very good before this escalation between Israel and Iran. I think this further makes it harder to execute the diplomacy that CIA Director Bill Burns and other top U.S. officials have been engaged in places like Cairo, Egypt, Doha, Qatar. I think it just further detracts from the possibility of a diplomatic settlement. And that was one hope that the Biden team had, which is that a temporary ceasefire that led to a hostage release could be used as a bridge to broader diplomacy that would de-escalate tensions across the region. All of that, you know, it's not impossible to achieve right now, but the odds of it occurring, I think, are much lower now.
How long can it go on with thousands of people on the verge of famine and, you know, an angry Israeli population regarding the hostage release?
Yeah, I'm afraid it could go on for quite some time. And it's for one simple reason, is that the two main parties to that conflict, Israel and Hamas, have not found a pathway to use these diplomatic efforts to settle some of their differences, even temporarily. That instead, they've seen force as the means to actually test the limits of their power. And unfortunately, that's had the highest cost of all for more than 30,000 Palestinians who live there. But my sense is that the Israeli public, as well as this Israeli government, but the Israeli public itself wants to see the security threat that Hamas has posed and demonstrated on October 7th. They want to see it eliminated. And that's where I think it's going to likely be a long, hot summer in Gaza, unfortunately. And I think the Rafah operation that Israel has planned, though it's delayed it, I almost see it as inevitable unless Hamas actually adopts a different approach in these negotiations and says, yes, we'll release some hostages. Yes, we'll accept a temporary ceasefire.
This has been going on for so long, and it's for years and decades, you know, this ongoing hatred engulfing the region, the tensions, the unrest. It seems almost at this point to talk about a two-state solution or any sort of peace in the region just doesn't even seem like it's feasible.
It definitely does seem so far from the current moment, but I do think it's important to articulate some sort of endpoint to this, in a sense, to try to rally the attention and the resources that would be needed to achieve it once the conflict's over. So in my travels to the Middle East, and I'm going to Saudi Arabia in a few days, there's still ongoing discussions about those long-term plans, even though there's an ongoing conflict and multiple conflicts now, and even though it's a crisis moment. And I think it's important to do those two things at once, as unrealistic as it may seem, in part because you want to have not only the military operations that are being conducted, but then the diplomacy for the short-term issues like the hostage release and temporary ceasefire. You want it to be connected to some sort of long-term vision. The problem with that two-state solution is that not a lot of the parties, including the current Israeli government, agree to it. And that's why I think what we're looking at here, for many reasons, is a multi-year effort to try to tamp down tensions, to end the conflict, but then to produce those sort of outcomes. And it's likely to take, it certainly will outlast the Biden administration, even if it wins a second term, because I think this is 5 to 6 years. It takes a long time to align these things to end conflict and then move forward on things like the two-state solution.
We really appreciate your taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow for foreign policy at the Middle East Institute. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. After a months-long stalemate over continued U.S. support for Ukraine, Congress plans a vote this weekend on legislation to provide billions in desperately needed wartime aid for Ukraine. House Speaker Mike Johnson gained approval for the vote, which many in his own Republican majority opposed.
We look forward to every member voting their conscience and their desire, and that is exactly how this process is supposed to work and how the House is supposed to operate. So we're happy to provide that.
Describing this as a pivotal moment in history, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Michael McCaul described seeing images that evoke Hitler's rise to power.
As we look at the map and our adversaries, remember Mr. Meeks and I going to Poland to see the refugees fleeing out of Ukraine. And he could have taken a black and white photo and it would have looked like 1939. And that's exactly what the Poles told us was, this is 1939 all over again.
Increasing Russian attacks in recent weeks have hit urban areas and energy infrastructure across Ukraine. CIA Director Bill Burns, in remarks Thursday at the George W. Bush Presidential Center, said Ukraine's future could well be in Congress's hands.
Without supplemental assistance, the picture is a lot more dire, I think. There is a very real risk that the Ukrainians could lose on the battlefield by the end of 2024, or at least put Putin in a position where he could essentially dictate the terms of a political settlement.
Also this week, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba at the G7 Foreign Ministers meeting in Italy urged Europe to step up support and the House of Representatives to approve the military aid for Ukraine.
The future of Europe is being decided in Ukraine. The future of Middle East is being decided in Israel. And the future of the world order is being decided in both these places.
At the same time Russian bombardments intensify, there is a coordinated international effort to investigate and seek justice for war crimes committed during Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Joining us to talk more about it is Ambassador Clint Williamson, the lead advisor of the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group for Ukraine. Can you tell us a bit about what the group is tasked with and what the goals are?
The Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group is a consortium of five non-governmental actors that are implementing an assistance program on behalf of the U.S., European Union, and United Kingdom governments. So the idea behind the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group is to create an accountability vehicle that will allow the three governments to kind of operate in a coordinated fashion, to speak with one voice on accountability, and to support the Ukrainian government in its investigation and prosecution of war crimes. And so why this is so important is that in Ukraine, although the International Criminal Court is engaged, they will just necessarily be limited to a small number of cases. And so 99% of the war crimes cases are going to have to be dealt with in the Ukrainian domestic system. So it's very important to make sure that they have the resources, the capabilities to do this. And that's what the three governments are trying to do through the ACA.
We've been hearing almost from the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that war crimes were being committed, stories of mass graves that we heard. Can you speak to the potential scale of Russian war crimes up to this point, and are they ongoing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went out to Ukraine a week after the full-scale invasion. So I went with a small team of people at the request of the prosecutor general. We were on the ground 8 days after the invasion and started working with the office of the prosecutor general. I think our first meeting was on March 3rd, 2022. At that very first meeting, at that point, they had already registered around 300 war crimes cases. Now that number is over 125,000. So it is just on an enormous scale. Those numbers will come down some. I mean, there obviously will be some reporting. There will be some cases that probably shouldn't have been classified as war crimes. So there are a number of things that'll bring the numbers down, but we're still talking about tens of thousands of cases that they're going to have to deal with. It's going to be impossible for the court system to deal with every single one of these. So they are going to have to prioritize cases, have to determine which ones are more serious, those that involve multiple deaths, those that are particularly heinous, those that are occurring on a large scale, things like that that will go into this kind of triage process, for lack of a better word, and that they'll have to narrow down and then figure out which of these cases they have to pursue. But this process will go on for years and years. If you look at the domestic systems in the Balkans, places like Croatia and Bosnia, they're still dealing with war crimes cases 30 years on. And I think that's going to be the same in Ukraine.
This war is reaching a pretty critical point for Ukraine, a pretty dire situation with the vital U.S. funding having been stalled for months. And Russia seems to be taking advantage of that in recent weeks, targeting Ukrainian cities. Even this week, an 8-story apartment building in a northern Ukrainian city hit, apparently a hospital. And also we're hearing, or we're seeing, what it would appear to be intentional targeting of Ukraine's energy sector. Would it appears to be an effort to cripple Ukraine's electrical grid. Would that constitute a war crime?
It can. And I think the way that the Russians are going about this, it does constitute a war crime. So without getting too technical, there is a concept that's referred to as dual-use targets. So these are targets that are primarily civilian in nature, but can be used for military purposes. So, for example, if you have a factory that is producing mainly civilian cars, but is also producing tanks, that would be a dual-use facility and could potentially make it a legitimate target for military attacks. So it's a question of proportionality. You have to determine what is the military uses of a certain facility, and does that justify the attacks. What we are seeing, though, I think, in Ukraine is the targeting of facilities, of a lot of different buildings and places that are almost entirely civilian in nature. And clearly the intention of the Russians here is to create deprivation in the civilian population, to make it difficult for Ukrainians to go about daily life. And the scale, the scope of these attacks over an extended period, I think, argue very strongly for this being an intentional attack on a civilian facility, which is a war crime.
So prosecuting international war crimes, as you mentioned, takes years and years and years. The International Criminal Court in The Hague, about a year ago, issued arrest warrants for Russian officials due to the forcible deportation of children from Ukraine. Will part of your work be to see any of these war crimes Ukraine is trying to take on within its own justice system? Will that be any quicker, or as you said, will it just all be just years and years from now?
What I was meaning when I talked about the process going on for years, I think more in the sense of it's just going to take that long to get through these investigations, these prosecutions. There will be additional evidence that will emerge, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that will help to identify perpetrators that may not be known right now. So cases will continue to be produced over time. The reality is that at the moment, Ukraine has very few Russian perpetrators in custody. They have some who are prisoners of war, but most of these tend to be very low level, you know, perhaps conscript soldiers, where you might have one soldier who killed one person. So it is relatively small scale crimes. Those they can prosecute, and they can put people physically on trial in a court in Ukraine. Beyond that, they will be issuing indictments, arrest warrants against more senior figures, but right now they don't have any ability to to put these people on trial. So unless they are tried in absentia, Ukrainian law allows for trials in absentia, but I think they will use that only on a limited scale. Whether those people will ever be brought to trial in Ukraine physically, it's hard to say. You know, there could be a change to a more rule of law oriented government in Russia at some point. Right now, that seems unlikely, but you know, stranger things have happened. When I was at the ICTY, I drafted the first indictment against Slobodan Milosevic when he was president of Serbia. At that time, no one thought there was any chance that the ICTY would get him into custody. Yet he was overthrown a year later, and a year after that was extradited to The Hague for trial. So stranger things have happened. And, you know, we may see some of these people arrested at some point down the line. Some of them may travel to third countries. They may get arrested on Interpol red notices. So it's not a useless exercise to get these indictments in place in the event that they travel, in the event that changes occur in Russia, which allow their trials. And also just by having these cases brought, it substantiates what everyone sees is going on. It helps bolster the case for maintaining sanctions against Russia as a state and against individuals who might be involved in crimes. So it will be a long process. As to how many people are actually physically tried, I think it's very hard to predict that right now.
This is kind of a somber question, but you know, we've been hearing the voices from the Pentagon and from the United States and from international Western leaders from all avenues that Ukraine can't hold on much longer without getting the aid it needs to survive. How will their justice system be able to hold any Russian actors accountable if it falls in this war?
I mean, this is an existential conflict for Ukraine. And it is a democracy. It's a state that's based on rule of law. Certainly it has its problems, as do all democracies. But, you know, they are in a position to investigate and prosecute these crimes as long as Ukraine remains a free, democratic, sovereign state. If that changes, of course, their ability to pursue this and their willingness to pursue these cases would likely diminish. Just to kind of put this in context, when I had this first meeting with Ukrainian prosecutors a week after the invasion at the Polish-Ukrainian border, one of the first questions they had asked me was, what advice would you give us? Just what kind of things do we need to be doing right now? And one of the things that I had mentioned was, you know, you need to make contingency plans in the event that Kyiv falls. You need to be able to get files out to make sure your witnesses are protected, your senior staff are protected. And to a one, they almost laughed, but they just said, Kyiv's not going to fall. And this was at a time when all of the intelligence services, you know, in the United States and in Europe expected a quick Russian victory in Ukraine. But it was this sort of attitude, this spirit in Ukraine, which has been there from the very beginning, which has really kept them going this whole time. What I see now, though, is this spirit starting to flag. People are not as confident in victory. There is a sense of resignation that things are getting worse. I think they're still confident that Russia is not going to prevail militarily, but they are worried. And I think it's not only if Ukraine does not succeed militarily, it is also going to be a defeat for rule of law and for accountability for war crimes. And because they just are not going to be in a position to deal with these cases if this war ends on effectively in a Russian victory.
Ambassador Clint Williamson, lead advisor of the Atrocity Crimes Advisory Group and senior director for international justice at Georgetown University. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.